Welcome to BFF Live. My name is Scott McCulloch. Today we have the great pleasure of welcoming Sach Chandaria, who will speak to us about setting goals and overcoming the fear of failure. Sach is a fifth-generation member of a diverse family business with interests in base material processing, media, technology, and electronics. The Chandaria family began from modest origins in East Africa almost 100 years ago. Sach and his family focused on nurturing entrepreneurial talent in sectors with global growth potential. He has vast experience as an entrepreneur and working with entrepreneurs. He's a board member of BFF, and Sach has unique insights on goal setting and not being afraid to fail. He joins us now for our inaugural BFF Live session. So why should we not fear failure? What are some of your thoughts there, Sach?
For me, the value of failure is twofold. One, as I was saying, is, you know, more and more we're getting accustomed to a life where everything is very predictable. You know, if you do A and then you do B, then you get to C. And I think that you know, reality and work and just life is actually not exactly like that. And I think what failure does is it kind of brings you back in touch with that reality. So that's one reason why I think failure is valuable. The second thing is that when you fail, it's often painful and it really hits a raw nerve. And I think that it does that because you're learning something very valuable. And you know, there is the more painful it is, the deeper it touches you, I think the more important the lesson you're learning. So it is a tremendous way to learn in a complex world.
Give us your personal insights there. Of course, at Business Families Foundation, we're all about family enterprise. How might you sort of apply these concepts to a family? How might a family business apply concepts of goal setting and embracing it?
So let me start with a kind of philosophical point. I mean, I think the whole value of, you know, being part of a family is, you know, it gives you a certain, it creates a certain cushion. It creates, you know, it somewhat protects you against a lot of the, you know, vagaries of life. And I think it gives you some protection against, you know, all of the kind of negative things that you may face. And I would say, you know, because of that, it can often lull you into complacency, right? And I think, because families actually have this cushion, because they have this support network that they create for individuals, it actually allows them to probably encourage family members to take, you know, even greater risks. Because even if you take a risk and if you're going to fail, you know, you actually have that cocoon, that cushion to hold you up and to support you. So to come to your question, you know, how in a family business, how would we embrace goal setting and encouraging people to fail? Rather than trying to protect and just kind of shelter future generations from you know, some of the issues of life, I would say actually encourage them, tell them to go out and take risks, do things that are a little bit ambitious and crazy. Because, you know, even if you fail, you are very privileged in the sense that you have family to fall back on. You have a cushion that you can still come back to and you know, get back onto your own feet. So in a sense, being part of a family allows you the luxury of taking even bolder risks than you may if you're just a standalone individual.
You speak from personal experience and from the family perspective. And I was just wondering, do you have any personal anecdotes of your own specific challenges that you've had to face over the course of your lifetime and your family business?
I'm an expert at failure, actually. Jokes aside, I will give you, you know, one experience, which, you know, which is kind of particularly telling. And I think on one hand was extremely humbling, but I think on the other hand, it really gave me some tremendous insight. So after I finished business school, I decided to go and work in one of our businesses in China. You know, we have a lot of investments in the contract manufacturing, electronics manufacturing space, and one of those businesses was just setting up a subsidiary in Shanghai. And you know, I went there. I was interested by this because it was an important sector for us, very dynamic area. I was going as part of a startup team, so I was not kind of just shadowing somebody else. I mean, I was really going to fill a functional void that existed. And I was the only, non-Chinese in a totally Chinese management team. I mean, it was a little bit tempered by the fact that the senior management were Singaporean Chinese, but this was full on China. And I can tell you, I probably made every mistake you can imagine in China. I mean, what you and I might think is common sense is absolutely not common sense in China. I mean, people think in a different way. You know, the social dynamics are different. Even the most basic things. I mean, just I'll give you a personal anecdote, which really, really seems pedantic, but it'll illustrate you the kind of issues I'm talking about. And this is not on the business side, but we when we were in Shanghai, we had a we had a maid that was helping us at home. And one evening we were having a big dinner at home, and we were expecting her to come to help, and she just didn't show up. She didn't show up. She didn't call. She didn't do anything. And we were just flabbergasted. We were dumbfounded. Then I kind of realized that actually, this is for her, if she had actually done what I would have thought as a courteous thing, which is to call and say, listen, it turned out she found another job. It was much better paying, whatnot. She just called and said, listen, I'm not coming. I can't, I've got this other job. It's much better, And I mean, we would have been upset, but we would have understood. But, in China, for her to have actually called us and said to us that, she's found this other job, she would have probably put us in a position where we were losing face. And that's a big deal in China. And again, so it's from small things like that to large things. I mean, I learned by making serious mistakes. And I would say what really added further insult to injury is that, I just graduated from business school. I was full of confidence, really thought I could, change the world. And I got a very, very hard dose of reality very quickly.
Sounds as if you have had a lot of cultural factors involved in some of your successes and your failures. I just want to take a moment now just to remind our listeners that if any of you have questions for Saj, please use the chat function on your screen, and we will try to get to them during this webinar. Saj, I'd just like to turn the questioning now just to all things entrepreneurial and entrepreneurship, and I'd like to get some of your insights. I think our listeners would benefit from some of your insights on your personal approach to developing leaders, and more specifically developing entrepreneurial leaders. What are some of your thoughts with regard to that particular concept?
So let me just give a little bit of context of what it is exactly that we do in our family business. So we started out really as entrepreneurs ourselves, but for a host of principally family reasons, we decided actually to get all family members out of entrepreneurial or managerial roles, taking any kind of operational responsibility. And I think what that did is it morphed us from being entrepreneurs ourselves to what I would define our core purpose today as, being facilitators of entrepreneurship. I mean, our mission or our purpose is to identify a very particular breed of entrepreneurial talent. And then when we find these kind of people, It is to create the best environment for them to succeed, right? And I mean, not to go into too much detail, but essentially by that I mean we provide them very, very patient capital. We give them complete operating leverage, so we get out of their way where we're not going to add any value. But we work closely with them where we can add value, where they need help, and where, you know, we feel we can really support them. The essence of what we do as a business, you know, speaks to what you're talking about, which is nurturing that entrepreneurial fire, really fanning it and making sure that we are creating the environment to encourage people, you know, both to take risks, but also on occasion to fail. Now, the way we do that is, and this is really, really, I would say, fundamental and sacrosanct for us, right? We do not want, and sorry, there's one other important point that I think it's important I make, which is that when we come into businesses, we generally come in with controlling interests. So, and that was important to mention because, look, from a shareholding perspective, from a board and board right perspective, I mean, really, we can do whatever we want. But one thing we choose very, very clearly not to do is we don't interfere in operational decisions, right? So we don't take decisions. I mean, we leave it to management. They have to take the decision. We will not take the decision, because if you start taking the decision, you take away the responsibility for both the positive and the negative results of that decision. And if you're going to start doing that, then, you know, you're undermining the very essence of the kind of fire that you are trying to cultivate within this entrepreneur. So, you know, the first thing we do is absolutely make sure that we don't take decisions. And I will give you a live example. I mean, I've been in a specific situation where there is something that the business, you know, that the company, you know, wants to do. I think it's something worthwhile. The CEO was a little bit reticent. And the CEO said to me, listen, you know, Sach, if you want to do this, then we'll do it. Right? And then I just stopped and I said, listen, I will give you my opinion, I'll give you my views. But at the end of the day, you've got to make the decision. Right? It's not me. I'm at the end of the day, I'm not the one that's going to be held responsible for this. You know, it's your baby, it's your call, it's your decision, you got to make it. So, you know, that's one. And the second thing we do is failure is part and parcel of entrepreneurship. Everybody creates wonderful business plans and it's always an uphill trajectory. The reality is it's never like that, right? I mean, you always will face fear or will face failure. And so I think what we do is when that happens in the business, you know, we don't dwell on it. We say, look, you know, we went in eyes wide open, we made these choices and it didn't work. Right? And I think we will not aggrandize the failure. We will just kind of move on. I think what we will, however, seek to do, you know, at the right time, probably after a little bit of time has passed, is come back and review that failure to really make sure, you know, after the emotion and all has been stripped out, that we understand, you know, what went right and what went wrong. I mean, you know, the value of failure really fundamentally lies in the lessons you draw from it. And you know, so that part is really important as well, is to go back retrospectively and look at what happened and understand what you did wrong so that, you know, you can make sure you take advantage of that lesson and implement it, you know, in a different way going forward.
Well, you've certainly given us and our listeners quite a bit of food for thought there. I just want to go back to some of the key points you made in your comments just moments ago when you were talking about how your approach is as a facilitator or as an enabler when it comes to developing entrepreneurial leaders. I just want to build on that a little bit by looking at whether you need some sort of spark to spark an entrepreneurial fire, as it were. Can you give us any thoughts on how it all begins at the very, very beginning of a new venture or something entrepreneurial?
I mean, at the end of the day, it is, I think it, I mean, for me, it just fundamentally boils down to just having a fundamental passion, right? Or just having a deep-seated belief in wanting to do what you're going to do. Honestly, often to a point of irrationality, right? Because, you know, and the reason I say this is, you know, this cannot just be a cerebral calculation, right? I mean, this has got to come from your gut. And there's got to be variables in this that are driving you that you may not necessarily be able to explain. And the reason I say that's important is because, again, entrepreneurship is tough. I mean, you know, we only hear about all the success stories, but I guarantee you for every success story, there's 10 failures. There are 10 failures because it's tough. And if you don't have that conviction, if you don't have the ability to fail, pick yourself up, get back on the horse and start riding and do it again and fail again and fail again, then you will succumb to the challenges of entrepreneurship. And you know, at the end of the day, it's just that basic belief and that basic drive. So you have to feel, you know, you have to really, really deeply feel passionate about what you want to do. And you know, for us, I mean, that's fundamentally what we look for. I said to you that we look for a particular kind of entrepreneur. I mean, when we spend time with them, you know, it's not just about telling me your business idea and you know why you're so interested. It's about tell me your background. Tell me about your parents. Tell me about your brothers and sisters. Where have they come from? What have you done? Tell me about your life journey. Tell me about, you know, where are your grandparents from? What's the kind of policy? Because I think all of these, you know, will give you fundamental insights on what is driving a person, the nature of their passion, and how deep it flows. And I think that's you know, that's really fundamental, because that is the core belief that will overcome all forms of failure that you may bang your head against.
It's something that one needs quite a bit of patience, and it's like the old adage: if you're going to fail, that's fine, and just fail it and keep at it. And speaking of patience, Satch, perhaps some thoughts on, you know, why is patient capital, why is it important? Why is patient capital important in nurturing family leaders? Any thoughts on that particular concept?
Is patient capital necessary for nurturing families? I don't know if I would necessarily make that link. I think patient capital is necessary for you know, building entrepreneurial businesses. And for me, the reason is simple, is because, and I think this gets to this, or, you know, sorry, let me turn the question around. I think that, you know, there is a reason why families tend to be the source of patient capital as opposed to other. Because I think families have the ability to look longer term and you know, don't necessarily have the same, you know, motivations and inclinations and incentives that, you know, that institutional or you know, other forms of capital have. And I think that patience is really important, simply put, because building a business is not a, you know, 5 to 7 year private equity window type adventure. I mean, it takes, you know, it often takes a long time to build a business. I'll speak to a live example of ours. I mean, we have, you know, one of our investments is in an animation studio in the family entertainment space, and this year will be our 20th year. And I mean, honestly, we have. I mean, this is a kind of great story, because I think it certainly tested even my patience, and I was intimately involved in the business. But you know, sometimes, and particularly if you're trying to do something ambitious, you need time, and you need to give the business enough runway to figure it out. And that's what we've seen in the animation studio. I mean, you know, I think quite frankly, have probably made every mistake there is to make in this kind of business. But at the end of it, have come out that much stronger for it. And I think now we really are positioned to build a solid business and create some meaningful value. So I, you know, it was not a direct answer to your question, but I think I was trying to turn it around to, you know, what the value of patient capital is.
No, that's terrific. It is much appreciated. And you've given us more than enough food for thought here at BFF and for our listeners on the web. I just want to perhaps try to wrap up with some of your thoughts on, you know, what your key messages would be for today in terms of just summarizing some of the concept that you feel strongly about.
So I'm a father of two kids. I have a 15-year-old daughter and a 12-year-old son, and this is genuinely, you know. So this is kind of advice that it's not just academic advice. I mean, this is advice that I plan to use with them. It's what I was saying, you know, in one of my earlier comments, which is, you know, when you're part of a family, and particularly if you're part of an affluent family, you know, you often get too protected, and I think that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, that's also part of the value of a family, is that, you know, it does give you that protection. But, you know, there's a benefit and a cost to that, you know, protection. I mean, there's a benefit because it gives you a sense of security. There's a cost because, you know, oftentimes it means, you know, as an individual, as a family member, you know, you don't have to ask the hard questions to yourself. And I think that that's a disservice. I mean, I think that often, when everything gets paid for, you have a nice life, you don't really have to think about, you know, too much, and, you know, you just have a family business to go into, you know, you can often flow through life without even asking yourself, what's really important to me? What am I passionate about? And I think that, you know, and I want to make sure that, you know, that's not the experience that my kids have, because I think you're doing them a fundamental disservice if you don't help them truly discover what their passion is. And I think encouraging to take risks and fail if need be is a really important way to do that. And I think, as I was saying before, the security blanket, the cushion of a family, you know, quite counterintuitively, actually gives us the option of encouraging them to take even more risks than, let's say, a normal person might. So, you know, in one sense, you want to make sure that they're feeling safe and secure. On the other hand, you want to push them out the door and say, you know, dude, just, you know, be bold, be crazy, do something. Fail if you have to, but that's okay. So, you know, that would be kind of my, you know, those are the issues that are important for you. I mean, certainly at a personal level, but, you know, even to share with everybody.
That's terrific, and thank you for that that summary. We have a question that's just come in from Olivier de Rechouf, our president here at the Business Families Foundation, and he asks, is there a structured process for grooming responsible owners? Any thoughts on that particular and very specific question for you, Zach?
I mean, I don't know if there's a structured process. I mean, I think each family needs, you know, each family has to figure out kind of their own path, because, you know, each family has its own unique set of dynamics. But I mean, here are lessons that we are learning right now, right, through some of the issues that we're going through as a family. And that is that, you know, you have to have, you have to have a mechanism by which family members, you help family members discover what their strengths and weaknesses are, right? And, you know, in a normal work environment or something, that it kind of just naturally happens, right? But, you know, when you're a family member working in a family business, you're in an artificial environment. You know, things may happen not because of your competence as a manager or as an employee. It just happened because of your last name, right? And that, you know, that, so I think you've got to find a mechanism whereby you really do help family members kind of understand what their strengths and weaknesses are. And you know, again, I'll tell you from our own experience, I don't know if family members are the best way to teach other family members that, right? You know, maybe sometimes you need to bring in some independent like professionals, independent people that can help with something like that. So I think that's very important. And again, I think once you identify that, you can then begin to channel that into an area where, you know, the family needs that skill. And I think when you do that, you're essentially beginning to match, you know, a person's own, you know, passions and strengths with, you know, what the needs of the organization may be. And I think in doing so, you are creating a virtuous cycle where, you know, they will become responsible. I mean, they will do what they're enjoying. They're working for something which is their own. And you know, if stewarded properly, I think it will lead to be playing a meaningful and value adding role, which is, you know, I think fundamentally what the responsibility is about.
Well, thank you very much for those insights, Thach, and thank you very much for sharing your anecdotes, your experiences, your learnings, and of course your passion. We've pretty much run out of time here. We've taken our full 30 minutes. I just wanted to thank you again for your time and your insights. I want to thank our listeners for joining us for this inaugural BFF Live. And of course, invite everyone to join us next month when we welcome Sumitra Aswani of Singapore-based Ish Program Foundation. Thank you again, Thach, and thank you to our listeners.
Great, Scott. Thanks so much, and have a good rest of the week, everyone.